Welcome to the FIRE Podcast, a project of the Heartland Institute's Center on Finance, Insurance, and Real Estate, where each week we bring you the latest in financial news from a free market perspective. I'm your host, Ray Lehman. Our guest this week, Alex Tabarrok, holds the Bartley J. Madden Chair in Economics at George Mason University. He also is the Research Director of the Independent Institute in Oakland, California, and one of two primary contributors to one of the web's most popular economics blogs, Marginal Revolution. He joins us to discuss his new book, Launching the Innovation Renaissance, A New Path to Bring Smart Ideas to Market Fast. So let me say, welcome to the podcast, Alex.
Great to be here. Thanks, Ray.
So this is an e-book, which is a format I'm learning to like, and I'll probably enjoy much more once I sit down and actually buy an e-reader. So I read it on my laptop, which is not the most convenient way to read a book, but it's sufficiently concise that doesn't present too much of a problem.
It looks great. It looks great on the iPad. I think it looks great on the Nook as well. So you got to get one of those.
Yes. Okay. Now your co-blogger at Marginal Revolution, Tyler Cowan, with whom you've also written an economics textbook, also used the ebook format for The Great Stagnation, which presents this basic theory of about how those of us in the West, and particularly the United States, have essentially culled the low-hanging fruit of innovation and productivity enhancement, and that one of the reasons we're experiencing this prolonged period of sort of stagnant economic growth post-1973 is that that's caught up with us. And if that book was a diagnosis, your book seems to offer the cure or a set of cures. And so did you intentionally set out to respond to Tyler?
No, actually. I started this book before I knew about Tyler's book, Tyler's a very fast writer, so
yeah.
He showed me a draft of his book, and I was actually pleased to see that they're quite complementary in just the way that you suggest. Tyler's book is a diagnosis of as you said, the Great Stagnation, the reduction in technological productivity, improvements in technological productivity, and I basically accept that diagnosis, but I'm more interested in, well, what do we do about this problem? How do we increase the rate of innovation? What are the positive signs for the future and so forth?
So you trace back the roots of some of the institutions that have historically been supportive of innovation all the way back to Renaissance era Florence, things like patents, prizes, public education, and so forth, and that maybe while they've served us well over the centuries, some of them maybe went wrong somewhere along the way. So let's start with patents, because you devote several sections to that. You're not necessarily convinced that patents overall have proven their worth as drivers of innovation. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, I think we've pushed patents much too far. There are several problems with patents. You know, first of all, they're just not necessary in many cases. So I talk about roses. You know, new roses have been propagated and created for thousands of years. There's never been a shortage of new roses, and yet there haven't been any patents for roses until 1930. So in 1930, we passed the Plant Patent Act, and suddenly you can patent roses. Interesting thing, however, is even today, most new roses are not patented.
Right.
So why do we need this? Why do we need to create these monopoly rights, which means that on some new roses, you can't even take a cutting and plant it in your backyard. That would be violating the law to take a cutting from a patented rose and plant it.
Right.
So often these patents are simply not necessary.
Now, I know I found sort of fascinating the discussion you had about Edison's light bulb, that there had been a prior patent that was challenged, I guess it actually eventually ended up in the Supreme Court, that didn't specify the specific material, bamboo, that would be used for an incandescent light bulb. And Edison went through 6,000 substances before he found what would work. So the courts at that point still viewed the work that went into creating a useful product as being important to a patent, that seems to have gone by the wayside somewhere along the way. Do you have any sense of how that happened, how we got to where we are today?
Yeah, it's a pretty recent phenomena. So a lot of the problems with patents have been created not by legislation, but by judges who have simply decided that patents need to be interpreted in a much broader way than has traditionally been the case. So what was interesting about the Edison case is, just as you described, the law back then was quite similar. The judges could have interpreted differently, but they chose not to. And what happened was that a Sawyer and Mann tried to patent a light bulb using any fibrous material as the element.
Right.
They didn't try very many fibrous materials. You know, they just put in their patent, you know, we have this patent for any fibrous material. Edison actually went out and tried 5,000 different possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
He eventually settled on bamboo, not just any bamboo, but bamboo, which as the court described, he had to dispatch a man to Japan to
mm-hmm.
find just the right bamboo.
Right.
So, nevertheless, if the court had decided that the Sawyer and Mann patent, if they had thought about it broadly enough, you know, bamboo falls under fibrous material. Instead,
yep.
what the court said is, no, you can't do this. He said, look, the court said, you actually have to put some effort in. You can't just write down your idea and expect it to cover everything. And
right.
since Sawyer and Mann didn't actually go to the trouble of finding out the right fibrous material out of the thousands possible, they declared that, you know, Edison's patent was valid and not the Sawyer and Mann patent. You know,
and what's interesting about that
yeah.
is that if you don't actually do the work, then you are stifling innovation because you have a patent that is essentially going fallow. If the courts were to uphold just the idea without a working light bulb, then no one can create a working light bulb if the holder of that patent doesn't do so. So that's interesting. I mean, that's something that you see a lot contested now in technology, in particular in software patents, where you know, there are thousands of these that are held, and they're held mostly defensively, held to, you know, fend off lawsuits from other companies, should you one day wish to get into an area you're not in now. So perhaps there are changes that you've suggested some in this book, changes to the patent system, whether they be shorter patents, different kinds of patents for different kinds of industries, having to demonstrate sunk costs, or having patent auctions. Why don't you go through some of those?
Sure. So the first one is, you know, judges should just not interpret these things so broadly. And that's something which judges can do tomorrow. They did it in the past, and they can do it again today. Say, listen, you can't just patent an idea. You actually have to patent a product, something real. And then going beyond that, there are a number of potential ideas, such as you described. You know, I think it's kind of crazy to offer exactly the same patent for every possible field of invention. So why is it that a pharmaceutical, which takes 15 years to develop and $1 billion of research and development cost, that gets a 20-year patent, the same as a one-click, you know, shopping for Amazon gets a 20-year patent? That just seems crazy to me. And why not? So what I suggest is let's create some classes of patents. Maybe a 3, 10, and 20-year patent, let's say. And we can allow people to choose which one they're going to apply for. And we'll say, okay, the 3-year patent, we'll approve it quickly and with less investigation. A 10-year is going to take more investigation. If you want a 20-year patent, then you'd better show you've got something really innovative, that you put in really some expenses, and you better justify that. So I think that would be a very reasonable thing to think about.
Another thing I've always thought of, you don't get into your book, but we've always sort of taken for granted that patents, we call them intellectual property, but it's more than just property. We grant a monopoly. I mean, you could, for instance, consider patents to entitle the holder to, say, some form of royalty, but they don't hold the monopoly. You could allow open licensing that might, you know, follow some sort of fee schedule, whether it be, you know, a set amount, dollar amount, or a percentage of revenues, but any other competitor could pick up the product and run with it.
Right.
That, you know, it creates other problems. You know, the amounts that you would pay would end up being set by government fiat, but you take a little bit of market freedom away on one side, but you add other market freedom if competitors, you know, have better economies of scale, better production processes, and so forth.
Right. Another thing along those lines is, I mean, I think the public has a very misperceives patents. The public thinks that when somebody sues somebody for infringing their patent, that they think that what's going on is that someone copied the patent.
Yeah.
You know, that the infringer took the idea and used the idea which was not theirs. And yet, most of the time, in a patent lawsuit, there is actually never even a charge of copying. Because the problem with patents, or a problem with patents, is that if two people independently have a similar idea, totally unknown to one another, the one who gets to the patent office first gets the patent and can stop the other guy from using his own idea.
Right.
So another possible patent reform, which I think would both be fair and economically efficient, would be to say, listen, there are prior use rights. If you come up with an idea independently and you're using that idea, and someone later comes and says, I have a patent on this, you can continue to use your idea so long as you didn't copy it. And, you know, we have lots of examples of independent invention. And there's no reason, if there's independent invention, there's no reason for monopoly at all. If there's independent invention, that suggests that there's lots of people trying to come up with these ideas, and we don't need to give one of them a monopoly in order to create the right incentives, because there's already lots of people coming up with the idea.
So you talk about other areas as well. I don't want to focus just on patents. For instance, there's a lengthy section on education. I think some of the main problems he diagnosed are we're not attracting very good people to become teachers. Perhaps too few Americans are graduating from high school, and too many are going to college. That sort of sounds counterintuitive, both would be true.
Yeah, let's talk about the teachers a bit.
Because
I think that's an interesting story about every silver lining has a cloud. And in this case, you know, it used to be that smart women, about the only profession open to them was teaching. When they weren't becoming doctors and lawyers, you know, in the 1950s and the 1960s, they would become teachers. And it was good, it was good hours for them, and it was a good job. And, you know, you had your summers off and so forth. So a lot of smart women went into teaching. Then in the 1970s, you know, at the beginning of the 1970s, you have entering classes in medicine, in law, we're talking maybe 10% are women. By, you know, 1978, 1979, we're talking about 30%, and rising up till now it's 50% or more. So once smart women had all these opportunities to become lawyers and physicians and so forth, they took those opportunities. And as a result, it is true that the quality of our teachers has declined. And I think that matters a lot.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that simply a matter of paying new teachers more? Is that the best way to go about attracting them?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I do think we ought to pay teachers more. We ought to pay them, you know, on par. It used to be, again, that a beginning teacher had about the same salary as a beginning lawyer. You know, today the lawyer on day one is earning three times as much as the teacher is. So I do think we ought to raise teacher salaries. However, that has to come at a price of greater accountability. There's no point raising teacher salaries when we have a situation, as we do today, when you can't fire even terrible teachers.
Right.
You know, it has become a Soviet-style pay system in which we pay math teachers the same as we pay phys ed teachers. As a result, we have a lot of great phys ed teachers and not that many great math teachers.
Yeah.
And you can't fire even the worst teachers. So yes, I would say higher pay, but it's got to come with more measuring of performance and a greater ability to hire and fire the best and worst teachers.
Now, on the issue of higher education, your other colleague over there, George Mason, Brian Kaplan, has a new book on the signaling view of education, that education doesn't necessarily add inputs so much as it does signal the sort of person that goes to certain types of institutions. And so I guess he's skeptical about whether more higher education actually adds value. Is that a skepticism that you share?
Yes, I think that there's a significant degree that's true. I mean, why is it that when you go and you study something like anthropology in college, you do end up with a higher wage, less than if you'd studied, you know, science or engineering? Maybe we'll talk about that in a few minutes.
Right.
But the question is, why? Why is it that anthropology students end up with a higher wage in the workforce when their job has nothing to do with anthropology? And I think the answer is not that they learned some secret while studying anthropology, which enabled them to be better business people or salespeople. They learned about the practices in the Amazon, which helped them to understand something in the modern workplace. No, I don't think that's it at all. I think what it says is the people who go to college, they're able to get through the degree with, you know, decent marks and so forth and just spend 4 years sitting and learning. That suggests that they're the type of people who are naturally productive, who have some productive ability. So that's why they earn higher wages.
But there are different sort of fields of study that might produce more skills.
Absolutely.
I think, you know, one of the things you point to is that we're not necessarily getting more people into those fields of studies, that they're are actually more students, or rather there were fewer students 25 years ago overall, but a greater proportion of them were studying computer science, chemical engineering, than there are today. In fact, in absolute numbers, there were more graduates in those areas than there are today.
I was shocked to find that there were more computer science degrees being given out 25 years ago than there are today.
I have to wonder about that somewhat. Is it just that people who are going into computers today aren't choosing computer science as their field? Maybe it's, you know, network engineering or something along those lines.
It's possible. There has been a growth in other areas which use computers. That's
right.
For sure. Still, when you compare the number of students in engineering, electrical engineering or computer science, and then you compare with the visual and performance arts, you know, there's more students graduating in visual and performance arts than in all of the engineering combined. And that has doubled in the past 25 years.
Right. As have journalism, which was my major, and I try to counsel prospective journalists who ask me away from, well, certainly away from becoming journalists, but if you do wish to become a journalist, you should study something else. There's no requirement that you study journalism, and that it's not necessarily a good road to. You should learn a subject, and then you can write about it.
Yes, exactly. I think we could use more of that.
Yeah. Now, another area you focus on is regulation generally. And we can start with sort of the concept that deregulation has been widespread is not necessarily true. I mean, airline deregulation, for instance, which occurred in the late 70s, did not extend to there being a great number of new airports. In fact, I think you mentioned that since 1978, Denver is the only major airport that's opened in the United States.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you look at China, it's kind of depressing. If you go to China, what you see is they're building dozens of new airports. They're building fantastic new roads. They're building infrastructure, dams, and so forth, wherever you go. And then you come to the United States, and we have a power outage every few years, which throws millions of people into the dark. It's really kind of depressing. And then you look around again in the United States, and you see something like the Hoover Dam, and you ask, could we build the Hoover Dam today? You know, technologically, of course. Technologically, yes, we could. But legally, politically, do we have the will? We can't even build a pipeline, the Keystone pipeline, you know, to bring oil from the tar sands down into the United States at a time when a barrel of oil is costing $100. We can't even get agreement on that. Never to produce something like the Hoover Dam today, I think, would be impossible.
Right.
There are simply too many interest groups of various kinds, too many of what I call veto players, too many people who can say no, and not enough people who can say yes and actually get something done. You know, this it's very much one of my influences is, you know, Manker Olson's Rise and Decline of Nations.
Yeah.
And what Manker Olson says in that book is interest groups accrete over time. You know, they build up over time, and as they do, they slow decision making. They make it more difficult to innovate, just as they throw sand into the gearboxes of society. And I think more and more we are seeing that is true.
Now, that's something I want to, and I'll probably wrap it up with this question, but it plays to a theme I think runs throughout each of these areas. And so I started by asking you about Tyler's book, and Tyler is sort of got a dim view of the situation that we're in. You offer a brighter way forward. But unfortunately, the way forward is tied up in some sort of vexing public choice issues, which is that the future beneficiaries of innovation aren't here to lobby for it today. And the current beneficiaries of various regulations and rent-seeking activity are, and they continue to hold a grasp of our political institutions. So what is the way forward? Is not this just sort of a tease that we could be doing all these things, but we won't?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the most positive developments is that the United States is actually no longer the only game in town. Mm-hmm. And this means we're going to have competition. Like we have never had it before. So, yeah, we really do need to shake up our system and break some of these log jams of special interest groups. But I think there's a possibility to do it when we start to look around the world and we see if we don't innovate, China and India and other countries will. These countries are climbing quickly. And when you see somebody approaching you, you look back and you see somebody catching up, I think that is going to be the spur to change some of our institutions, which is going to drive us forward. Because we absolutely can do these things. It's simply a matter of generating the political will. If we were alone in the world and just kind of declining slowly, then, you know, it's like the frog, raising the temperature and, you know, before it falls asleep. We've been falling asleep. You know, we have been falling asleep. But when we see these big superpowers, these big competing powers, and say, we could be that. You know, we used to be able to do that. We used to be able to build something like the Hoover Dam, like the road infrastructure which united our country. Why can't we now build an electrical infrastructure, a modern day Wi-Fi infrastructure? Why can't we do that the way they're doing it in other countries? I think that is going to drive us forward.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Alex. You've been listening to the FIRE podcast. For more episodes, please subscribe to us on iTunes or visit our website at outofthestormnews.com.